Senate Finance will come to order. We're joined today by Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, and Co-Chair Wilken. We have three pieces of legislation before us today. And Senator Wilken, any announcements?
No, ma'am.
You have a meeting here this afternoon?
We have a meeting, 1:30. General Frazier's going to be here to brief us on the status of the military.
So this room will be busy this afternoon.
It'll be very interesting.
The first bill we have up is Senate Bill 209, Underage Military on Licensed Premises. Josh, you're presenting?
Morning, my name's Josh Temple. I'm staff for Senator Huggins. I'll be presenting Senate Bill 209. Senate Bill 209 amends Alaska Statute 04.11.110 by authorizing access by persons under 21 years of age who possess a valid military active duty or armed forces identification card to a licensed premises without specific authorization of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board in certain circumstances. Under present law, persons under the age of 21 cannot be on any premises that are licensed to sell alcoholic beverages unless a parent or legal guardian accompanies them. Current law causes a dilemma to the underage veteran. Although they are eligible to join an organization, they are unable to go to the veterans' meetings or functions because they're underage. Now, this legislation will in no way allow the consumption of alcoholic beverages by persons under the age of 21 in licensed clubs. This bill will simply allow our troops access to the supportive and safe environments which they currently are not allowed. A military organization post will truly be a place where veterans across the generations will have an accepting atmosphere in which they can impart their wisdom and stories. This bill will help ensure a place of safety for our troops while they are on the home front.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Military organization, you're talking about the American Legion and places like that?
That's accurate. And if you will, Chair, Senator Bundy, if you will look at your packet here, there are two statements, one from the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, as well as one from Jean Michelle, stating that this won't apply to strip clubs or they can't broaden it. It'll simply be American Legion, VFW, DAV, things of that nature.
Yes, sir. Continue.
And so, but then you say that when they attend, they won't be able to drink. It's put a good deal of pressure on the bartenders and at these clubs to sort out the attendees and the people over under 21 and the one over 21 places like the American Legion are comfortable with this?
Chair, Senator Bundy. Yes, they are. They have complete understanding. In fact, we'll be having some come up and testify here. They will be very careful. They know their responsibilities, and they definitely do not want to lose their alcohol or their alcohol licenses, their liquor licenses, because that's where they get most of the money from.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking that it's going to be difficult for them, and if they make a mistake, they're placing their license in jeopardy. Thank you.
Welcome, Senator Huggins.
Oh, thank you, ma'am.
Joss has just gone through the sponsor statement and explanation very well. Would you like to add anything at this time?
Unfortunately for me, there's not much I can add after Josh has put his two cents in. He's very competent and professional, and I have tremendous confidence in his ability.
Are there any questions to direct to Senator Huggins? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just kind of curious when this issue first was brought to my attention from some fellows from the VFW and American Legion. I always assume that a soldier in uniform, under the age of 21, was allowed into establishments that served liquor. and ever since back to World War II, or maybe even before, and it wasn't an issue, but apparently that's not the case. And I'd like to have you just elaborate a little bit more on that, why at this time we need to make this change, and more of a clarification, because as a subject matter, I don't have a problem with the whole issue of someone that's old enough to serve in the military and go to Iraq certainly should have the maturity to go into these establishments and have some camaraderie, if alcohol's being sold or not.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Stedman. I think the first thing for us to realize is if you're a soldier at Fort Richardson, Alaska, if you want to get Jack Daniels, you can get it, because it's just the way it is. That's the first part. The second part, though, and the most important part, is germane to your question, is that service organizations see themselves twofold. A fraternal organization that supports, quite frankly, an older generation of people and kind of relives and is a cornerstone to doing things in the community. And the other major portion of the duty as they see to the community is that young people, in this case, like example, someone stationed at Fort Richardson that may be from Georgia, their parents are not available, and based on the technicality of the licensing, but more specifically, kind of the way the establishments are put together, if there's a Veterans Day ceremony in November, and afterwards that all the posts are open, American Legion, VFW, AMVETS, that based on the way most of the facilities are built, it's illegal for an underage person to be there unless they're there with their guardian. This takes away that technicality. The service organizations fully understand. I personally have talked to the state commanders, all of them, that this provision, if allowed, would require them to be more stringent, not less stringent. This is not about allowing people the opportunity to drink. It's about allow them to come in and for the service organizations to promote a patriotic environment and, if you will, sort of be the mother and father away from home for young soldiers and airmen and Marines and the like.
Any further questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and good morning, Senator Puggins. I guess one of the questions I have is how do you know there's going to be enforcement of non-alcoholic beverages served to these underage military personnel?
Well, they live by the same ID provision that other organizations do. So there's an ID card provision. But like I said, quite frankly, in the normal kinds of things that we would see these young people at, this is not everybody huddled up to the bar. It's occasions where, you know, there's essentially a potluck sort of thing. But, I mean, it could be. But there is a carding provision, and it's more stringent, not less stringent, given if this bill were to pass.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. An announcement for information. We'll be recessing at 9:25, and we'll come back at the call of the chair. So we will probably complete the testimony, because we have some people who want to testify on this. And we also have Doug Griffin online to answer questions, and he's with the ABC board. Have any of the questions that come need to be directed to Doug Griffin? Okay, we'll ask him if he wants to answer any of those things. Any other further questions for the sponsor? Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm just a point of clarification. The bill would allow a military personnel in the establishment under the age of 21 that serves alcohol, but it does not allow them to consume alcohol?
No, does not allow. This will, in the organizations understand, this will require them to be more studious in their ID checks, not less. This is not about allowing people to come into the organizations to drink. It's just the opposite. It's about sort of mother and fathering these young people, not to have them join in a party drink.
Okay, But good, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Lydia?
If you're old enough, if you're 18 or 19 and you're old enough to go to Iraq and die for your country, you're old enough to go have a beer.
Thank you. So Doug Griffin, have you heard any questions that you might be able to clarify?
Take care of that problem.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Doug Griffin. I don't think so. I think Senator Huggins and his staff person are pretty well framed the issue. There is the concern that's been raised by Senator Bundy about the pressure on the bartenders and so forth. But again, in the hearings that I've heard prior, I think the people involved with these service organizations are well aware that this does put additional pressure on the bartenders to make sure that they are vigilant and not serving an underage person in this circumstance. And, you know, it's a trade-off. The points raised about these people serving our country in the military and their needing a place for camaraderie and so forth are certainly a positive for this bill on the one side, and as long as we can adequately address concerns about the consumption of alcohol by underage persons, I think we can certainly make this work.
Well, Doug, one question I have is it simply prohibited for someone under 21 to be in the building, or is it prohibited for someone under 21 to belong to the organization?
Senator Green, well, we have no jurisdiction over membership, so answering your second part of your question first, they can belong, and that falls outside of our jurisdiction. No, it's just a matter of that the underage, the club is viewed more as a beverage dispensary licensee. So it does fall into the same category as a bar, that it is actually illegal for an underage person without being accompanied by parent, legal guardian, or a spouse that's 21 or older to actually be on the premises. And that's what this bill would liberalize that standard a bit. Of course, you know, the other analogy I've heard in other hearings is that there are provisions to allow underage persons to go on places that serve alcoholic beverages for purposes of dining, and these are places that are more dining facilities and restaurants and so forth. So you're kind of mixing a little bit of that standard of allowing underage people onto licensed premises for a specific purpose. In the case of a restaurant dining, you're kind of adding a little bit of that into the club model.
Okay. Thank you. Does anyone else have a question for Mr. Griffin of the ABC board? Senator Stedman.
Yes, I'd like, Madam Chair, if I could, I'd like to find out from the ABC board why they would oppose us moving the drinking age to 19 for the application of the people that qualify under this bill, active service personnel within these patriotic organizations. I think it's egregious, the whole issue of how you handle someone that's 18 years old through boot camp and send them overseas relative to what they can do here in our own country. And I'd like to know.
Does that fall under your jurisdiction, Mr. Griffin?
Senator Green and Senator Stedman, through the chair, it's certainly a broader issue. I think it probably goes more to federal suggestions, let me put it that way. That's basically what occurred in this country back in the early 80s when the drinking age was raised to 21 pretty much universally. I think the state of Louisiana was the last to raise it, and it was done pretty much because some of your highway funding would be effective negatively if you had a lower drinking age than what was being recommended. I put that sort of in quotes by the federal government. I mean, they tied federal aid to, require states to raise the drinking age, and that's why in an area where you don't have much uniformity, the regulation of alcohol, the drinking age is one area where you have a great deal of uniformity nationwide.
Senator Bundy.
A question for Senator Huggins. It's been a long time since I've been in uniform, but Is it the practice on a military base at the EM Club, for instance, that a soldier has to be 21 to consume alcohol?
Correct, 21. There used to be an exception, to be quite frank, I'm not sure where that sits. There used to be a thing called 3.2 beer. That was the exception, but I do not know whether... Does 3.2 beer exist? Yeah, it comes away.
You're dating yourself. Thank you. So,
Madam Chair, yes. It sounds as if the military has their regulations that require age 21 as well, so I think your Senator Stedman's attempt is going to have to start a little higher than the ABC board.
Senator Huggins.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, through the chair, Senator Bundy, you know, actually the military has gone in the other direction. Things like happy hours and those kinds of occasions have essentially disappeared. And that's a two-edged sword. A lot of clubs on military compounds also disappeared because that was part of the revenue stream. But in any event, the military, based on, you know, conduct of people drinking and DW, it is an offense that if you have a DWI on your record, it's a career ender. I mean, it's a showstopper for you. So by virtue of that, a lot of events that promoted drinking sort of went away.
Thank you. Well, we have some folks here in the audience that would like to testify. And we'll have just a brief of these before we call John Wilkins up. Senate Finance's call back to order. Are there any other questions on Senate Bill 209? By the way, Senator Bundy, thank you for completing the testimony on that so those gentlemen could get on about their daily life. Senator Wilkins, we have a motion.
Madam Chair, move to report Senate Bill 209 for committee with individual recommendations and attached to zero fiscal note.
There being no objection, Senate Bill 209 moves from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Heather, are you doing that? Okay. Thank you, Josh. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. In 2004, Congress established the Alaska Rural Justice Commission.
Heather, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. For the record, Heather Brakes, staff to Senator Terrio, the sponsor of Senate Bill 210.
Thank you.
I'll just start over. In 2004, Congress established the Alaska Rural Justice Commission, recognizing many rural communities face the highest alcohol abuse and family violence rates in the country. The commission was appointed by the U.S. Attorney General and was originally to present the Alaska Legislature and Congress with its recommendations by May 1 of 2004. It's my understanding that the commission has been granted an extension and in late 2005 released a draft report. Senate Bill 210 was drafted in response to some of those recommendations that were made in that draft report. The bill before you does several things. It would make it clear that alcohol transported by common carrier, it would make it clear that alcohol may be seized and forfeited that is transported by common carrier in violation of local option laws. It allows for the authority to seize property determined to have been purchased through the proceeds of illegal importation or the sale of that alcohol. It proposes a streamlined procedure in forfeit proceedings when a person might claim an interest in the property seized in these bootlegging crimes. And it clears up inconsistency in statute as it relates to the presumption of guilt. When the quantity of alcohol in possession is more than 10.5 liters, it would be presumed that the person possessed that alcohol for the purpose of selling it. Madam Chair, there are over 100 communities in Alaska that have chosen a local option to limit or completely ban the sale or possession of alcohol. As the Department of Public Safety reports in its 2004 annual report on pages 7 and 8, you can see that bootlegging is a very lucrative business in rural Alaska. The department reports 681 gallons of alcohol were seized, and below that, it shows the number of arrests associated with those interdictions. Senate Bill 210 provides clarity, consistency, and strength to beverage control statutes in order to assist law enforcement and communities in fighting the illegal importation of alcohol. And with that, I believe Doug Griffin is in line with the, he's the director of the ABC board. Lieutenant Keith Mallard from the Department of Public Safety. Mm-hmm. They can answer questions as to their experiences.
I believe we have Ed Harrington from the State Troopers and then Doug Griffin from the ABC board.
Okay.
Do we have questions for either of those gentlemen from the Troopers or the ABC board? So this was all a direct result of the commission and the work they've been doing.
Right, their draft report.
I have a question, Madam Chairman.
Yes, sir. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm not sure who to ask the question of, but how was the number of 10 and a half liters decided upon as opposed to the 12 liters that were there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, in two other sections of statute under this same provision, the amount that constitutes a felony in terms of transporting alcohol into a local option community is 10 and a half liters of this distilled spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing here is making making it consistent to say if you possess more than that amount, then there's the presumption that you had it for the purposes of selling it.
It makes it consistent with other amounts stated in law, correct?
That's right, Madam Chair.
And that's state law?
Yes, mm-hmm. sir, through the chair.
Are there other questions? Senator Bundy.
For Doug Griffith, perhaps, alcohol comes in different sizes of bottles, but would a case of alcohol be how many liters, and or a case of half gallons, or?
Doug, did you hear the question?
Yes, ma'am, Madam Chairman. To Senator Bundy through the chair. Sort of backing up, the 10 and a half liters, now that's the amount that a package store can legally ship to someone in a given month, calendar month. And that's where that came from. And that was put in there when the legislature reduced it a little bit a few years ago. And I think Senator Hoffman was sort of the person that came up with that figure based on six of the bigger bottles of spirits, the 1.75 liter bottles. That's a case of that type of spirit. Six 175s gets you to your 10 and a half liters. So there's that question. In a case of fifth, that's a 750 milliliters. A case of that is whatever, 750 times 12. That's a case is generally nine. That would be 9 liters of liquor that come in 750 milliliters, which is considered a fifth of liquor.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it just helped us get an idea of physically how much alcohol we were talking about. So it'd be a case of what else?
Case would fall under.
Old timers of half gallons would call it a case of half gallons. Yeah. All right, thank you.
And Ed Harrington from the State Troopers, did you have any information to share with us?
Not really, Madam Chair. I was here to answer questions. You know, I would say that I was on the subcommittee for the Rural Justice Committee and was part of making these recommendations to the change in the statutes. Last year we did, the drug unit did seize approximately 994 gallons of alcohol, which is a pretty dramatic increase over 2004 stats. And these changes in the statutes here are just kind of a additional tool in our tool belt to help us enforce the local option laws to those communities that have elected to restrict the flow of alcohol to their communities.
Okay. Are there any further questions? Senator Olson.
Go ahead with...
And I'm not sure who to... I just want to make sure that the situation with a common carrier... I have it clear in my mind that air taxis, especially out in Bush, Alaska, are not... I guess, how does this affect them?
This is Captain Harrington. I think maybe I can address that. I don't believe this change would really affect them at all. It kind of... It more helps law enforcement for the fact that alcohol transported by common carrier gives us the ability to seize that alcohol, where in the past we always haven't had that option. And, the alcohol has to be forfeited eventually through court proceedings, usually at the criminal hearing.
Well, I guess I'm not comfortable. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm not comfortable with somebody that's not sure how it's going to affect them, especially when you're dealing with aircraft that are getting more and more expensive out there, and I'd like to have some more clarification as to whether these aircraft are going to be confiscated or not by the law enforcement people. And I certainly don't want to interpret this as a way that I'm condoning bootlegging, but I think we have to have more concrete information as to what these aircraft and their confiscation capabilities are going to be dealing with.
Okay, Senator Harrington, Captain Harrington, can you explain, is there a difference proposed in this statute versus what is current law as pertains to the transporter of the product?
Madam Chair, not to my understanding, maybe Doug Griffin can back me up here on this, but... I think that change with the transportation by common carrier refers specifically to the alcohol beverages transported by common carrier, and I don't think it was the intent of this language to seize any commercial aircraft transporting alcohol through rural communities. I mean, generally, as it stands now, we don't generally seize or do anything with common carrier aircraft. We have seized a plane or two over the past 2 or 3 years that have been privately owned, and those planes have been specifically involved in the importation of alcohol by private carriers. So from my understanding, this statute doesn't affect common carriers at all or the seizure of common carrier aircraft beyond what the statute's already covered.
Senator Olson, does that help?
It does, but could I go on to another question, Madam Chairman?
Okay, well, I think, just a moment, I think Annie Carpinetti has something to add to that discussion. No?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I just wanted to make sure that Captain Harrington's, he was absolutely accurate. This bill does not change the definition of common carrier for our bootlegging statutes.
So if I'm interpreting you correctly, the common carrier's aircraft are not going to be confiscated even if they knowingly carry alcohol into the villages?
Through the chair, they may, but not. The bill doesn't make any difference. It allows the alcohol on common carriers sent in violation of the bootlegging laws to be to be seized and forfeited. It doesn't say anything. It doesn't have any. Doesn't address the seizure of the aircraft itself.
I could go on to another question, Madam
Chair. Senator Bundy, was your question on that topic?
No. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Senator Olson.
On page 3, line 3, it has, or items of value purchased from the proceeds. Can you give me a better definition of that, or more a layman's definition of what we're looking at?
Through the chair, would you like me to answer? I think that, and Captain Harrington would probably give you a more practical approach, but what I think this means is items like snow machines and various other things that bootleggers buy with the result with the money that they gain from their bootlegging.
I guess how do you prove that?
Well, it's like any other lawsuit. You have to go in and have evidence that this item was purchased with funds obtained from bootlegging, and it's a, the burden of proof is by a preponderance of the evidence in a civil action.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. For Captain Harrington, did I understand you said you confiscated last year 994 gallons of bootleg?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy. Yes, sir, that's correct. It was 994 gallons.
Yeah, now, so that quick calculation would be something nearly $300,000 worth of potential bootleg profit that you confiscated.
Yes, sir. Actually, I could probably give you. Maybe I could give you the amount here. I don't have it right.
Yeah, that I don't know the exact.
Close to that amount.
Yeah, I don't need to know the exact amount. Just I'm just trying to get ballpark figures. And if I might continue, and the discussion of confiscating property and other items of value, if you could give us an idea of maybe cases that you've made of how much money was involved in the bootlegging process. I mean, did a specific bootlegger buy a snow machine? Did they buy a house? Did they buy GM stock? What did they? In what volumes are we, as far as money, are we talking about in cases that you have experience in?
Yes, sir. Through my experience, I can tell you that it's fairly common for people that are involved in bootlegging in the rural communities to have to be fairly wealthy by community standards, and frequently these. The bootleggers, the active bootleggers, will spend a lot of their money usually on conveyances like boats and snow machines, jet craft, you know, jet skis, that type of thing. The more expensive toys. You know, I can talk about a couple of cases that we've done out of Cotton where the investigator was able to follow a vehicle from the airport, for example. Where they were loading alcohol into a vehicle, had followed the vehicle to the beach, where they loaded the alcohol onto a boat to take to a local option village. And upon doing the interviews, gets admissions that the alcohol was going to be bootlegged into a local option community. So we would go ahead and seize that vehicle and that boat. And then oftentimes we'll do follow-up search warrants on those kind of cases, and we'll find out that the person has two or three brand new snow machines or another boat, that type of thing, and generally through interviews we can tell that the person has spent the proceeds from his bootlegging efforts to purchase that equipment, and then we'll go ahead and seize that and proceed with forfeiture through the court, usually at the criminal trial.
This may be difficult, but could you hazard a guess as to the volume of money going through the bootleg process? In last year, right, statewide?
Oh, boy, I don't know if that's a real tough one to answer. You know, I can tell you an amount that we seized statewide for all of our cases, which would include drugs, and that was just slightly over $1 million. But I couldn't really give you an estimate for the that amount that's broken out specifically by alcohol.
But would that have been last year that you'd seized over $1 million in value of drugs and alcohol?
No, sir. Actually, I was just looking at the report and realized that it was for calendar year 04.
'04, okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess as I'm looking at this items of value, and I'm assuming Ms. Carbonetti can go ahead and answer the question. Senator Bundy had asked about GM stock and some of the other investments that are out there. If somebody bought a house, does this allow the home to be confiscated as well?
Through the chair, I think that would be highly unlikely. I suppose in an extreme case where a bootlegger bought a house solely from money obtained from bootlegging profits, and the second thing is that we could prove that, mm-hmm. It would be possible. I would say that it would be highly unlikely. Captain Harrington could testify as to whether we've even done that, and I don't think we have.
Well, I'm not asking what the practicality is. I just want to know what the law is going to be, this, what this legislation is going to be allowing. And I guess the other question has to do with what degree of money is out there. If a person had a $100,000 house in a small town and $10,000 was put by bootlegging money, does that allow this legislation allow for the confiscation of that home?
Of the house? I don't believe so, no.
How would I know that?
Well, because most of the value of the house is not obtained from bootlegging. If you'd use $10,000, I suppose a creative person could say, well, you put $10,000 down payment that you got from bootlegging into this house, and we would like that money back, but we wouldn't go and ask for forfeiture of the house.
But this legislation would allow for confiscation of the house.
I don't believe it would allow for the whole house. It might allow for confiscation of an interest in the house, but not the building itself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
Senator Bundy.
Well, just along that line of questioning, thank you. If a bootlegger has no other apparent or no other source of income and purchases a home, then wouldn't it be possible in a trial that they would lose that home?
Well, I guess it would depend on what the evidence shows. I mean, we would have to show that all that money that was used to purchase that home was derived from illegal transportation of alcohol. And prove that the whole amount of the purchase price was put into the house, and then I suppose this does allow that. That's not what generally happens. I don't think it's ever happened.
Well, if I might, if you're buying a snow machine you don't have any other source of income, that's confiscated. If you're buying a house, you don't have any other source of income, I would think that it should be confiscated as well. I mean, I guess we're trying to conject.
I think it depends
what
on the
courts would do, and that's a difficult thing.
But Annie, yes. Isn't the new language in this legislation actually allowing the person who is being questioned to have a response and to respond to the state and lay out their case as to why it shouldn't be?
Oh yes, it happens. It would happen. This house or something like that would happen in a civil lawsuit where we would have to meet a burden of proof, and the person would have an opportunity to make a defense, and it would be decided on the facts of the particular case. We wouldn't just be able to go and without, you know,
this is the
legal proceeding.
Madam Chairman, just the broad powers that I'm somewhat uncomfortable with this legislation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are there other questions? Senator Hoffman.
Yes, my question maybe will go to the Department of Public Safety. With this change in statute, how many do you, and what number of increased convictions do you anticipate?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. You know, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I don't know that I could really give you an accurate number for the increased seizures. It would give us, of course, with the reduction in the presumptive amount for sale, that would give us the ability to make a few additional cases throughout the year. I don't think the numbers would be anything substantial.
What I'm trying to get at is, what impact can we anticipate? What good is this going to do in stemming the flow of alcohol to dry communities?
You know, actually, the changing that limit or lowering that limit from the 12 liters to the 10.5 is as much to clear up the confusion between law enforcement and the Department of Law and citizens in general, because of the differences between those two statutes there, and I'm not sure that the average or the most common way of alcohol being shipped is in the 750 milliliter bottles, and essentially that's going to reduce the amount. 12 liters currently is 16 750 milliliter bottles, and the reduction to 10.5 liters, that will reduce that to 14 750 milliliter bottles. So the difference will be essentially two bottles for people importing alcohol. And there again, I don't anticipate that increasing our arrest numbers so much as just improving the differences between those two statutes, the confusion between those two statutes.
So you're saying that this is just streamlining the statutes, and maybe we'll get three or four more cases of a year for the department to prosecute, but the vast majority of the problem will still exist.
Yes, sir. It will streamline or make it easier to understand the statutes, and you know, I anticipate that we'll make a few number of cases. I just off the top of my head, I couldn't really estimate a number. You know, probably less than 50 would be my guess. Additional cases through the course of the year.
A staff has just brought it to my attention that this language was taken directly from Section 1730.116, which has to do with drug forfeitures, and it's the identical language, and it's just simply shifted to another section of law to pertain to another of substance that can be abused.
And
language is currently in.
And my question is, I've been working on this problem for many years. I think the first legislation on stemming the flow of alcohol was introduced and worked on by my office starting in the late 1980s. And I'll be supporting this legislation, but I want to make the committee aware that it's a very difficult problem. There's no silver bullet, and it continues to be one of the major causes of problems in rural Alaska, the abuse of alcohol.
And as with many substances that people abuse, you know, all the efforts in the world don't necessarily address the heart of the problem, which is the heart of people and the minds of people to make better choices. Senator Olson, would you like for us to hold this over for a day so you can kind of set your mind at ease?
I guess one of the things that I could perform, or would like to go ahead and go ahead and propose, Madam Chairman, if I could, would the sponsor be opposed to putting a conceptual amendment in there under the page 3, line 3, where it says items of value that we would accept the primary residence? And that would be one of the reasons I would like to go ahead and hold it if that could be worked out.
Okay. We'll hold this over, and you can discuss that with the sponsor.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Could I please just amend something that I said before? Ms. Briggs just showed me a paragraph of information in something that you have describing an apparent forfeiture or seizure and a current process of trying to seize a residence where there are 100 marijuana plants stored in underground grow. Crimes, and I would be happy to find get information about whether that was in fact successful, whether the residence was forfeited or not, or whether even people lived there. It may have just been a place where they were really illegal marijuana. But I'll be happy to do that. I just wanted to note that too.
Well, we'll have this back on Friday, and you can work on it again. And then it's my intention to pass it out.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, on Senate Bill 237, I know we have some folks who've been in the room for quite some time. I'd like to hear from them. This is MAC relating to courthouses and judges. Senator Wilkin, would you move version F?
Madam Chair, I would move that the committee consider a committee substitute for Senate Bill 237, Finance Version F, dated 2/14, as our working document.
Okay.
Is Is it version F? I didn't hear it.
F.
F is in Foxtrot.
Okay, and there being objections, version F is adopted for discussion. Susan, would you like to come join us? Chris, do you want to come on up at the same time and direct questions back and forth? Please note that this original legislation, which originally included only the increasing the number of Superior Court judges around the state, has had added to it the information relating to the compensation of justices and judges, which I know you may have heard Chief Justice Brenner refer to the current status of the salaries of our judges to be 47th in rank of the states that record that kind of information. Susan, are you going to present?
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
My name is Susan Parks. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here in support of Senate Bill 237. Just to give you a little history on how the bill started, the Attorney General had been going around visiting district attorney's offices around the state and talking to judges, and was struck by consistently hearing about how the criminal justice system seemed to be getting bogged down. It was taking incredibly long periods of time to get cases to trial. There did not seem to be enough judge time, courtroom time, to keep the process moving. This prompted him to meet with the court system, the Commissioner of Administration, who supervises the Public Defender Agency, OPA, and the Governor's Office. And the result was us coming to you in support of additional Superior Court judges. As the chairwoman mentioned, originally it was an additional four judges, but we are in support of the six judges in the bill. I'm cognizant of your time. I'd be happy to talk about sort of a lot of factors that have impacted the processing of criminal cases. Cases have become more complex. There are more parties involved. There are new crimes. There's a lot more technology involved in cases, all of which have made these cases slow down. The pretrial processes are slowed down. There's more expert testimony. But in addition, the numbers are up. I think it's a confluence of factors that have created this problem. Historically, in the last 10 years, our felony referrals in the state have gone up 64%. At the same time, we've only seen a misdemeanor referral rate up 15%. So felony crime is up in Alaska, and you couple this with the increased complexity of getting these cases to trial, and we have the situation we're in. Palmer is the number one priority for the department. I believe it's the number one priority for the court system. I think you've got information in your packet about the population explosion in Palmer. That has created a crime explosion in Palmer. Just briefly, 2002, we saw 595 felony referrals. 3 years later in 2005, we had 869 felony referrals. The caseload just keeps going up. As indicated in some of your materials, the Palmer court system is so overloaded, they've had to go to doing night court for small claims matters, traffic ticket matters. Cases are taking an incredible time to get to trial. And another thing that impacts caseload is the type of cases. And for example, in 2005, Palmer saw 12 homicide cases referred to them. So again, you get these bigger, more complex cases, it really impacts and slows down the system. I have facts and figures for Anchorage, Kenai, Fairbanks. I'd be happy to share with you if there's specific questions. I guess one thing in Anchorage I'd just like to note, we looked at how many cases were currently pending trial in Anchorage. They've got 279 felonies pending trial, 82 of which are over a year old. So it's taking cases a long time to get to trial. 28 of the cases pending trial are murder cases. And if you try to figure out how many weeks of trial and how many judges are available, you can see that really the system isn't serving the public, it isn't serving victims when it takes this long to get the cases moving through the system. So I'd be happy to answer any specific questions about any of the areas that I can. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I look at the legislation, Ms. Parks, on page 2, the bottom of the page there, where it says the number of judges, I guess I noticed that all the districts except one have an increase in numbers. In the district that I have represent, it looks like the numbers of judges are staying the same. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that is correct. The first judicial district
gets 40 instead of 34.
Correct. And, you know, I think, and I defer to Mr. Christensen in terms of the court caseload numbers, there are certain areas of the state that we just really aren't seeing the backlog that we're seeing in some of these more populated, and it is some of our more urban courts that seem to be having the problem with the increased criminal load, and of course the civil caseload in those cases also impact the judges available to process cases.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the presentation to the legislature, the Chief Justice also stated that even though there have been increased number of judges in the Bethel district, the court system has not been able to fill that position because I think primarily of salary. And I was wondering, has that been looked at and is that addressed in this legislation in any way so that that position can be filled? You know, I think that the testimony that he gave in his presentation, it was because primarily of salary that the position has been left vacant and not applied for, and it's envisioned at its current rate that position would stay vacant for another, possibly another year. And I'm wondering, it's the same as not having a position being authorized if we are not able to fill that position. And Bethel is one of the courts that is most backlogged, and I was wondering if you might address that.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I'd actually defer to Mr. Christensen, who could probably address this question better than I.
For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, Bethel is a tremendous problem. This position has been vacant for 9 months. It could be vacant for as much as a year and a half to 2 years. Right now, we're sending judges rotating in from Fairbanks, to cover these cases, which hurts Fairbanks. We've taken asked two judges to come out of retirement and each spend a week a month or 2 weeks a month in Bethel until this situation is resolved. It's not good for the community to have this rotating group of judges go on in. This is largely a result, we believe, of salaries. Rural judges get a dramatically lower geographic adjustment than any other state employee. The geographic adjustment is so low, in fact, that judges in rural Alaska are not even the highest paid government lawyers anymore. For example, last year in Nome, the local district attorney made $20,000 a year more than the local superior court judge. The reason judges have a lower geographic adjustment is because for many, many decades, up until around 1990, our judges were paid the same as a federal district judge is paid. Starting about 1987 to the 1990 era, the salaries began to dramatically decline, and they're now making 40% less than the federal district judge. So with the low geographic differential and the dramatic decline in relative salaries, you just can't get people to move out to some of these communities to serve. This bill does contain salary adjustments for all judges. It does not bring them quite up to the level they used to be. It does not bring the Superior Court up to the level of a federal district judge. It does bring the Supreme Court up to that level, with the other courts adjusted proportionately downward. And we believe this salary level would probably go a long way towards taking care of this problem we're seeing, not just in rural Alaska, but elsewhere.
Brad? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dyson, excuse me.
Yeah, thank you.
What percentage of the caseload for the Superior Court judges are civil actions?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, at the present time, approximately 25% of their caseload are felonies, and another 5% are juvenile delinquency matters. So everything else would be technically be civil, although it would be spread out among about 25% are family law cases, such as divorces and custodies. Smaller percentages are other things like guardianships, tort cases, contract cases.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, one of which was just addressed. I just wanted to make clear that the Fairbanks supplies support to Bethel.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was that I'm supportive of this legislation, and when you look at the increases, there's sort of a gulp factor, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think back to last year, just about this exact same time, we were sitting here talking about commissioners and how difficult it is to get people to come out of the private sector to be public servants as commissioners. And they got a big raise, and that was a gulp factor. And we're having the same problem across the state with our judiciary. And I'm supportive of this. It's overdue, and I'm more than prepared to pull money out of the operating budget somewhere else in order to fund this. So.
I have an idea.
Some parts of the operating.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yeah, I guess I'm a little bit more cautious than Senator Wilkin. I think we should have fiscal note from Department of Administration on the for the public defenders and the Office of Public Advocacy and possibly even the public safety for the troopers to get a better feel for the full impact. A little bit different. I guess there's two issues. One of them is the increasing the ranks, and the other one is the salary adjustments. It looks like there's definite need for the salary adjustments. The other question I have, Madam Chair, is if when we go through these bills, like, or these proposals, like the one we have in front of us, this falls into the area of having the additional actuarial analysis done, even though I think on the judge's retirement system and stuff that wasn't impacted, but we should look at impacted with Senate Bill 141 last year. But we should actually, I think, at least take a look at that to make sure that we're not in conflict with that particular issue, because I assume it's going to change the retirement system of this somewhat. And the third point, if I could, Madam Chair, is I'm concerned with the timing of the budgets. We haven't had the opportunity yet to work through the operating budget for 07. And some of the positions haven't been filled, numerous, in fact, sprinkled out, and we're adding more positions. And I guess I would question the timing of the legislation in the regular 07 operating budget to see if we can make sure that we don't do something with the legislation that then impacts our budget issue in 07. And I recognize Senator Wilkin said he's more than glad to make up the 12 million somewhere else. I don't know if the full 12 million is necessary, but clearly there's substantial increases in the 07 budget outside of what's in front of us today.
If I'm not mistaken, we were having a conversation about this earlier, the part of that capital may already be in, is it not already in the budget, the capital, the Kenai Courthouse? It is not in? Okay. Senator Dyson, you had a question?
No.
Oh.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. The bills have rung. Is there anyone else that has anything further to testify before our next meeting? Susan.
Madam Chair, could I just make a comment in response to Senator Stedman's, if I may? I can't speak for the Department of Administration. One thing about increasing judges, it's not going to increase our cases. The workload isn't going to increase. Actually, it does increase the number of courtrooms you're going to have to cover, and that may have an impact. But in fact, it's going to ultimately, we hope, increase efficiencies. I can tell you, I have attorneys who have prepared for homicide cases over and over and over again because they think it's going to get to trial and then it's delayed. And 6 months later, they've got to reread the same file. We have to contact all the same witnesses again. We have to pull together all this, and then it gets delayed again. And there's a backlog to get rid of, but really, in some ways, it will hopefully be more efficient for the system, and we won't be doing twice as much work on some cases as necessary. So,
it's very good. Well, there, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. I have one more question
that
relates to the question that regarding the Kenai Courthouse. Last year, we had made, while we're doing this and bringing judges, the number of judges up so that we can address the backlog of cases in the state, the issue of court space comes into mind since the Kenai has been mentioned. And last year we made appropriations for the expansion of the courthouse in Bethel and in the Valley. And it's my understanding that although we made those appropriations, there was considerable increases in construction costs. And how are those increases to be addressed? And if they're not, what happens to those two expansions, one in Bethel and the other in the Valley?
Chris, do you wish? There certainly have been cost overruns in the bids, and so we'll be addressing that throughout the budget system, budgets throughout this year. And we will request the fiscal notes that have been mentioned here today and be sure to clarify for everyone. And if folks have questions of either Susan Parks or Chris Christensen, make sure you get in touch with them because I intend to have this back up on Friday. And any further questions? Take a brief at ease. Mr. Wilkin, any announcements? Any?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay. With that, Senate Finance is adjourned, and see you mañana.